Right, can you hear me, everybody? We can maybe make a start. It's just after 4 o'clock, so if I let people come in, they can join us as we go along. My name's Peter Temple. I'm the principal examiner for the A302 exam. Been doing this since ASA decided to localize it, so I don't know how many years, quite a lot. Ryan Chigwinden is the other person that's going to be presenting, and Ryan is one of the examiners. For A302, we actually have two examiners who are responsible for the setting and the standards behind the exams as well. So that's the background to the two of us. What we're going to do is, I just want to talk a little bit generally, firstly, about the A302 exam, and then after that, Ryan is actually going to go through the technical content of the exam. I'm going to very briefly go through some of the communication aspects of the questions, and then we'll take questions as well if you've got any questions. Having said that about the questions, I'm also very happy for you to stop along the way and ask me questions. I think we both prefer that. So if you want something clarified, please stop us and ask us along the way. They do ask, because they're recording the session, that if you are going to ask a question, you need to ask it into the mic. So when you stick your hand up, we'll come running down with the mic and give you an opportunity to say your question, so it's recorded for eternity, and then we'll answer it. So that's just what we plan to do today. As I said, please just stop us. The purpose is really to make this as interactive as possible. Just to start with, how many people here have written the communications exam before? I assume those you're not here because you haven't, because you've passed. So those who haven't written it before, we're writing it. Few people, okay. Are you all planning? Is anybody not planning to write it to the next session, or is everybody here writing it in the next session? Anybody not writing? Okay, just one person looks like, okay, a very diligent person. So that just gives me an idea of where we're coming from. So, as I said, we're quite happy to take questions. What I'm going to do is, how many people have been to the session before? We did one earlier this year. Okay, two or three, four. Okay, so you might see some of the stuff that we've said before, but clearly you needed to hear it again if you're still sitting here. I'm just going to go through some of the general stuff just to give you an idea of a little bit of the general things, and then how we work, and then hopefully also just give you some general comments again about the communications exam. And the first thing is just to give you an idea. As I said earlier, we have two examiners, and they set the exam papers. And we also have communications experts, and we don't necessarily consider ourselves to be communications experts because we're actuaries. I don't think we're bad communicators. I think that's the reason why we're doing the job we're doing, but it's quite useful having people outside of the industry, outside of the actuarial profession, who actually help us. And one of the advantages of that from our perspective is that sometimes the things that we would consider to be straightforward, they from outside the industry are actually ask us and say, do you really mean that? Is that what you really meant? Is that what the candidate really meant? So it's quite useful from that perspective as well. We set the question. We work out a model solution. The examiners work out a model solution, and they work out a mark schedule. So in fact, you actually get three things. We actually try to give a solution that we think would be a good answer to the question. It's not the only answer to the question. I think that solution is actually published on the ASA website. It's not the only solution to the question that would get you a pass. It is just an example of what we consider to be good enough. And what we do that for is actually why we do that before we actually even mark the exam is, well, one of the things we want to check to see is it possible to actually answer this exam in the number of questions and number of words that we're actually prescribing. Sometimes people say it's impossible to answer that question in the markdown word count. You'll see that if you actually look at our word solutions, they actually do fit into the word count. And so it shows you that it is possible. If we can't answer it in the word count, we would change the question. So that's one of the reasons why we do it as well. So that's just the background to the exam setting side of things. If you're worried about the marking, you'll say, well, actually, how do I know that actually the marking is done fairly? We've got quite an elaborate process to make sure that our marking is done as fairly as possible. We start off marking actually three papers. You get randomly picked. If you're one of those three papers, you end up getting marked by all the markers and all of the examiners. So you've really got the most extensive marking that's done. But what that enables us to do is to have a look and see, are there any problems? Are there any questions? Have there been things that people misinterpreted and that we need to take into account when we actually come into the marking? So we have that, we mark those scripts, and then we have about an hour and a half telephone conference where all the markers are present on the call, and we go through the various aspects of those scripts to be able to actually understand and see what we are doing. And so it really does, it's quite an elaborate process, but I think it's quite a fair process to make sure that we do have a good, fair approach to the marking schedule and that we do. And then that marking schedule is actually adjusted. So if, for instance, we notice that a lot of the scripts are actually missing a particular point or misinterpreted something or changed something, we may actually change the marking schedule to allow for that, so that we've got a standardized marking schedule, and then the markers actually mark the papers according to that. Every paper is marked twice, once by an actuary and once by a communications person. So it's not just, again, randomly you might get a very strict marker. So that's one of the things we do. We amalgamate the marks 50-50. And then I review all of the marginal scripts and any scripts that are outliers between the what I would expect to see and what we actually do see. And I normally review about 30% of the scripts, those are the marginal scripts. So quite a significant chunk of people actually get effectively marked three times. So the chances are, if you fail the exam, you really have failed the exam, and somebody actually has really applied their mind to making sure that we have thought carefully about what you have done. So that just gives you an idea of where we come from a marking perspective. Hopefully gives you a little bit of confidence in that we're not randomly pulling your names out of a hat. I just want to give some general comments to the exam and to the communications exam before we go into some of the detail, because every time I talk about these things, I always say these things, and then we see the same things occurring many times. So firstly, people always ask us about what happens if I can't do a technical calculation or if I make a technical mistake in the exam. So this last exam, there was a reasonably technical question, one of them, and people battled with that. Ryan will cover that off in terms of how you can actually handle it. We differentiate by what we consider to be a minor technical flaw and what I would consider to be a fatal flaw. Somebody at your level already should have certain basic knowledge of actuarial things. And if you go against a basic actuarial principle and make a thing, if you say it should have gone up and actually should have gone down, and really we do expect you to know that it should have gone down, if you make a basic flaw like that, we consider that to be a fatal flaw, and particularly if you're giving advice to somebody based on that flaw, we will not pass you. Our markers will highlight that and say that's a fatal flaw in the answer that you are giving, and therefore you do not deserve to pass. Probably there are about 150 candidates, 160 candidates write the script. There are probably 4 to 5 people every session that make what I would consider to be a fatal flaw and are flagged by the markers. I will check that, and if I agree with them, we do fail them. So don't make fatal flaws, but we really don't expect you to at this point in time in your actuarial training. You shouldn't be making these flaws. These are not complicated things. These are straightforward things. So it's, you know, things that we would expect you to know better at this point in time in your career. So that is quite important. We are sometimes checking the accuracy and the understanding that you can present about a technical thing. So particularly if you're being asked to present something or give an answer to a layperson, your mother or your father or whatever it might be, we do want you to be able to explain that in a non-technical way to them, and you need to do it accurately. You can't lie to them, and if you lie to them or you misstate facts to them, we will not pass you as well. So that's quite important. So some people sometimes seem to think that they can get away with misstating or incorrectly stating facts and that we will just wash over that, we would consider that to be flawed and we would not pass somebody who does that. And interesting enough, often what happens is the communications markers will pick that up rather than even the actuarial markers. And when they pick it up, they flag that to us, and again, we will not pass those people. There are generally a couple of people in every session that do that. Anybody got any questions on that? The second one that I always talk about as well is, it is incredible to me that people make what I consider to be really stupid mistakes, and it really costs people, and I have seen people, it being particularly marginal candidates, really costing them their posts or not. And it relates around two things. Firstly, typos, just typing the wrong information in or using the wrong name or whatever it might be. And it's just somebody hasn't clearly gone back and read over their work. If you had have read over it, you would have noticed it. And then the small things are getting the simple things right. And this last exam, I can't remember the exact thing. It was one of the questions had a person's name or some details in it, and the person, one of the candidates I saw, actually just used something entirely different. I don't know where it came from. I don't know if they misread it or made something up or what they did. But obviously, if there are names in the question, you really need to use the names and as they stand in your solution. That's just a stupid mistake, and we really don't expect people to do that. Yes, question. I don't know. I mean, this is a letter to your mother. You can write. Familiar or too casual. I think we'd be happy to accept, if there was cultural differences or anything like that. That would be fine. I think you must just be careful that it's not too informal. Or too formal, and we'll talk about the tone of answering emails and things depending on who it is that you're answering to. So if you're writing to your mother, I would really hate for you to write, dear Mrs. Temple, and then give an email, because I would never write to my mother like that. I would probably write, hi mom, or something like that. And if what you write is from a culturally acceptable perspective, we would not penalize you for that at all. But I think you must make sure that your tone is correct. That's the crux of it, really, from our perspective. Answer your question? The third thing I want to talk about is... Sorry, yes, another question over there. I meant to let you speak into the mic, so I'm going to walk down here. And
So if someone makes a fatal error, does that translate into a symbol like an FD, or they can make a fatal error and still get an FA, or is it just a straight fail and you just don't mark the paper any further?
We still mark the paper, but I would say most times if the person was a pass, and then I would drop them to an FA or maybe an FB, but it wouldn't. Most of the time people who make fatal errors, there probably a few of them end up with FDs anyway, because they're already poor anyway. So, if it's a marginal candidate, I'd probably drop them to an FA. That's what you would normally see. The third thing that I've got is word count. I made this point, I know both here in Joburg and in Cape Town, the last session. If the question asks for a word count, and they always do, then you need to put the word count down accurately. If you misrepresent the word count, that is going to be an automatic fail. So we had two candidates in the last session that clearly misrepresented the word count. They were, what they put down for the word count was 100 or more different from their real word count. We have computers. We're also able to count. And that was picked up by the communications markers. We failed both of those candidates. In fact, I was very tempted to phone the two people involved and have a conversation with them about professional and ethical behavior, because I think that is actually testing your ethics. And we are an ethical profession, and we don't expect, if you misrepresent the word count, you will fail. I can promise you that right now. I'm not talking about a one or two word difference. So some people sometimes manage to add the thing up incorrectly anyway. When we're doing word count, we actually normally even define where you can count from and to. So we say exclude the addresses and count from the dear to the whatever or whatever we do. And that needs to count up to that. Some people still get that wrong, so there might be five or six words different between us and theirs. You'll lose marks, but you're not going to pass or fail on that. But as I said, the two people that actually did fail, that they had the word count was different by over 100. So it was a substantial difference, and we do note those things. Don't do it unless you want to write again. The next thing I wanted to say is regards tone. What I always ask people and I always say is when you finish, you should read through the letter and say, would you be happy to receive this letter, or would you be happy and or would you be happy to put your name behind this letter? That is a crux of a question. In fact, you'll see actually the communications markers actually ask themselves that question every time they mark the exam. We often sometimes have marks for that even. So we'll actually allocate marks to the examiners, to the markers, to be able to make that subjective call to say, would I be happy to receive this letter, or would I be happy to have my name signed to this letter? And that is a really good way of judging the level of the tone that you have got of the letter, or an email or whatever you might be sending. So please think about that. Just step back from it and think, actually, would I be happy to receive this? If you are a client and it's something meant to be explained to you, would you say, would you, at the end of it, after you've read it, would you be happy to receive it, and would you have understood it? That's quite important from a tone perspective. The number of times that we hear, I'll come to you in a moment, let me just finish the point. The number of times that I see people making really patronizing statements are just incredible. You need to think about who you're writing to. And sometimes when we're asking you to write to somebody, you know, with a reasonable amount of technical background and technical knowledge, and then you start explaining very simple things to them in very simple language, the recipient of that letter is going to feel very angry and patronized at the end of it. I used this example before because a few years back we actually had a letter to the Director General of the Finance Department that you had to write explaining something, and one of the candidates explained what inflation was to them. And I would hope that the Director General of the Finance Department knows what inflation is. And that's just a good example of exactly what you shouldn't be doing. It shows to me that the candidate really hasn't thought about who the audience is and what sort of tone they should be taking in the letter. And then sometimes people just make inappropriate remarks entirely. So a few years back we asked, the question was basically responding to a client who was dying of cancer, who had been told that they had 2 years left to live. And people would write things like, I'm sorry to hear of your cancer. I hope you make the best of your 2 years. And I kid you not, that was somebody said that on the letter. I also had somebody say something along the lines of, I hope the diagnosis was wrong. I'm not sure if I was a cancer patient and I was being told I had 2 years to live that I would like to receive a letter from a company that says something like that. It's inappropriate. You need to think about it and say, if you were in that situation, would you be happy to receive it? Lots of people battled with how to start that letter. You need to think carefully about how to do it and make sure that your tone is appropriate for that particular situation. So that's quite an important aspect to passing those sort of questions. You had a question.
It's not a very critical question. I just wanted to know if we missed out.
I think the numbering just skipped somehow either. So, sorry. I thought I'd fixed it, but it seemed to have got back to a strange number. And then the point about level, in terms of what you are trying to demonstrate. It's quite important that you think about the person that you're writing to, so not just from a tone perspective, but actually also what sort of level of technical content can you give, what would be acceptable from an explanation point of view, what's not acceptable. So what things can you assume? So if you're writing to your mother, you can assume different things from a technical level perspective than you can if you are writing to another actuary or another finance professional. You actually do need to apply your mind to that and ask yourselves those questions. I don't know if people want to pad words, but the number of times that people either explain things unnecessarily or repeat things is quite amazing. So people sometimes say the same thing and they try to say it in a different way two or three times. That makes it really hard for you to fit into your word count if you're actually explaining the same thing multiple times, because the question is not designed to allow you to do that. So you should check to see that you haven't repeated yourself. And then obviously the most important thing in terms of level is always going to be, I'm always going to gauge your level that you've got it right from the way you write your introduction and the way you write your conclusion in that situation. So the content almost is less important than how you start a letter in answering somebody and how you finish it. That is quite important in terms of the way that we gauge the level of a letter. One of the things that we want to check is sometimes you've got to be careful that you don't take a biased or one-sided view. I think again the question a few years back was a letter from the Actuarial Society to the Director General of Finance. You must be careful that you're not taking an industry view in your response in that situation. We would expect that actually you're thinking about the profession if you're writing from the Actuarial Society, and therefore you won't take a commercial view, you won't take the Old Mutual view or the Sunlum view or the Investec view or whatever it is. So be careful that you don't have a bias on industry, a profession, or from your company. So a lot of people are thinking if you work in a particular company, you might want to defend that company's viewpoint. If the question is not asking you to defend the company's viewpoint, you need to be careful that you don't. Just think about that quite carefully as well. And then obviously technical content is quite important. One of the things we always are testing some technical concept in relation to the question. It's never just a nebulous non-actuarial concept and how you would communicate that. We want to test some sort of technical actuarial concept. And it's important for you to identify what that is that we're testing. Particularly in a letter or an email, think about it and say, actually, what are they trying to test from a technical perspective? And then make sure that you cover that properly, both from a depth level and from the level and tone that you're covering off. It is always a good idea to think about whether you can have an illustration or an example to illustrate or give for you that particular question. Please don't force that in. Some people sometimes try to force things in. That's not good either. But if there's an obvious way of illustrating or showing something on a graph or giving an example of the situation in another way, that is very useful in terms of communication. You should think about it, and you'll see actually most of the model solutions for these types of questions that always will have some sort of illustration or example if we can naturally put those in. I've talked a lot about just getting the basics as well in the past. Get that all up. From our perspective, you can lose really easy marks by not doing the basics properly. A number of times people don't have the format right or the structure right of a presentation. They don't include word count when we tell them to include the word count or the slide count. They don't put things down like if they're writing a letter explaining something to a client, at the end of it you must have some means for that client to be able to contact you to ask further questions. They just forget that off. They get their addresses wrong, use paragraphs poorly. Those things are all going to cost you marks, and you don't want to be in a situation where you're losing easy marks when they are easily available to you. So the course notes, I think, are very clear in terms of what you need to do from a structure perspective. Make sure you do it like that. I would say probably 10 to 20% of people probably don't pass just simply because they don't get the basics right. We really do expect you to get the basics right, so don't lose easy marks on the basics. It's quite an easy thing to make sure you don't do. And spelling and grammar, sorry, that was the last one that's up there. And the spelling and grammar staggers me because you're typing the thing on Word, and Word very kindly highlights your spelling errors for you. I can understand if you type there T-H-E-R-E when you're meant to be typing T-H-E-R-R-E, and that's not picked up from a spell check. But the number of times that we see people's answers with clear spelling errors, which would definitely have been highlighted on Word, still staggers me. And again, you're just losing easy, simple marks that are getting taken off from a communications aspect. So please make sure that you just make sure you've done a spell check by the end of it as well. Does anybody have any questions? That's the sort of general stuff. Ryan's going to go into the detail of the communications paper, the last session's one, before I hand over to Ryan. Okay.
All right. What I like to do when looking at the questions is to try and break it down into pieces. So the first thing with this one was to establish what the facts are. What information are you given? And this one centered all around the life expectancy that was quoted in a newspaper article. Okay. So you were also given some information of some research you'd done that highlighted HIV and some issues around HIV. You were given some current fund membership by age and gender. You were told to ignore entrance to the fund. You could ignore exits other than death. And then you were given some life table statistics. Okay. So once you've established all the facts and information that you're given, the next step is to establish all the instructions that you've been given. Now, in this one, the question was very explicit about what you had to answer. And you'll find this in a lot of the questions. They're guiding you through a process of getting to the conclusion. So it's very important that you identify each of those instructions and make sure you follow them. A lot of people lose marks because they don't complete all the instructions. They omit a significant number of the instructions. Okay. So this one you had to start off by giving a definition of life expectancy. You had to include some reasons for why life expectancy might have changed up until 2005. And you'd been given a clue in the question that had to relate to HIV. Then the two other time periods, 2005 to 2014, and then after 2014, what could you expect? All right, you had to just make sure that the audience understood why the specific number was not particularly attributable to any individual, okay, which is quite important. Then you had to do some calculations, and this proved to be a major sticking point for a lot of candidates in this paper, so I'll come to that one in more detail just now. Calculated the expected age of death, so once you had the life expectancy, that was quite easy. And then lastly, calculate the proportion of people who were actually going to retire. Because remember, the fund member's concern here was that because life expectancy was less than 65, there was no point in saving for retirement. They wouldn't get to retirement. But we have to show them that's actually not correct. All right, so the three things that a lot of candidates admitted were those bottom three instructions. What would happen after 2014? A large proportion of candidates didn't cover that. The life expectancy calculation, and then even the proportion of members getting to 65. There was a very high proportion of candidates who didn't calculate that. The other thing you need to just bear in mind is that in that set of instructions that I identified, there were eight of them. You've only got 10 slides. So you need to be able to fit in answering all of those within your 10 slides, and you still need to be able to do the introduction, your contents, and what you're planning to set out, and then you need space for a conclusion. So it is it's a tight fit. You need to use your slides appropriately. Okay, so let's deal with that life expectancy calculation one. I think in a lot of probably a very, very small portion of candidates actually managed to do this. So what do you do in a situation where you get a question and you don't get the formula and you are unable to recall it and you can't derive it? Then what? What do you do? So what you can do in this situation here is make an educated guess. We're not testing the process of getting to the answer. We just asked for the life expectancy number. You can make an informed guess of what it could be. But I think what you need to do then is highlight to the examiner that you have done that. Not in your presentation itself, because you're not presenting that to your audience, but in the notes section or something like that, just draw attention to the fact, to the examiner, yes, I understand this is not, I haven't calculated this correctly. I don't know, if I haven't got the details to do so. I've made an informed guess. And then you carry on. Because I suspect what happened with a lot of these candidates who got stuck on this question, it derailed them through the rest of the paper. They spent too much time worrying about it and then put themselves under pressure for the rest of it. So if you get stuck like that, that is one of the solutions to be able to deal with that situation if it arises. It doesn't excuse not trying, and candidates who get it right will do better. Okay. Right, and then just continue to focus on communicating. So you don't want to lose points because you're now distracted by this calculation that you forget about how you are communicating the message to your audience. Okay. All right, this one surprised me how many people didn't follow through with this calculation. It was fairly straightforward application of probabilities to a number of people. But a very high proportion of candidates didn't follow through on actually completing the calculation. So this one perhaps less excusable that you weren't able to do it. At this level, you should be able to apply probability factors to a group of people. The other important thing about this question, in doing this calculation, was it was the crux of the conclusion. To be able to show that 71% of members were actually going to get to 65, that was the message that you had to get across at the end. And that's what dispelled the members' concern that there was no point in saving for retirement. Okay. Right, and then Peter mentioned just when you've read the question, just try and get a good feel for what are we trying to examine, what are we after. So here, just perhaps make some notes for yourself: is what's the big picture, what's the main story that's going through this. And the key things in this one was that you had a life expectancy at birth. It's not a useful statistic for people who are 30 and 50 years old. And therefore, it invalidated the conclusion that the members were drawing from the article, and most were going to retire, and they would need to save for retirement. Okay. So, if you just have a high-level, quick view as to what are we trying to get to, it'll help you with your conclusion. It'll help you with trying to build your argument. All right. Then a couple of other things that go wrong fairly often. Peter mentioned this one is the accuracy. So copying numbers incorrectly from the question paper to your answer paper, it happens a lot. And I know it's probably the exam pressure, you're focused on trying to meet the time limit, and those simple, silly errors creep in. But they can cost you dearly. So make sure that you're using the right information, that you're copying information across. Calculation errors. In the next question, I'll highlight some that just are astounding that they're made. They really shouldn't be. They're errors that shouldn't be made. And then also, accuracy applies to choice of words. So your choice of words, the example that I highlighted there was the definition of life expectancy. So many people refer to it as an age that someone lives to, whereas that's only the case at birth. You needed to be more specific. It's the number of years that someone is going to live from an age. So it's very, very important that you actually make sure that you use the words to get across the meaning that you want. Okay. Also look for opportunities to use the information that you've been given. Very rarely is there information given in the question that you don't need. Okay, so if the information is there, it probably needs to be used somewhere. So that's a clue that if perhaps I've missed one of the instructions, I've seen a piece of information, I haven't used it yet, think about where you might have omitted using it. And there were some examples here where you could, people omitted the research that was presented back on HIV. Some people omitted to covering the implications of that, even though it was given in the question. Okay. Making sure you give a balanced view. So it's always expected, as Peter mentioned, you need to give the balanced view. But where in particular you have to be very careful is when you look forward. So the question around what can you expect to happen after 2014, you can't be, we're not clairvoyants, we're just trying to give a view of what we think might happen. And in that view, if there are alternatives that could happen, then highlight that, so that it emphasizes that you are giving a balanced view, particularly about things that are looking forward. Okay. All right, and then lastly, make sure your conclusion addresses your original question. Okay, so when you've started your correspondence, you've set out with an objective of getting a particular message across to the client or to the recipient. At the end of the presentation, in this case, your conclusion needs to sum that up and make sure that they've got the most important message. Okay. A lot of candidates will just have a couple of key items that in the summary or the conclusion that they've drawn from the what they've produced so far. But that's not what the conclusion needs to do. The conclusion needs to tie it all together and make sure that the whole message was got across. Okay. All right. Any questions on the any other questions? Sorry, any questions on the sort of technical content of the question?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, just strengthen what Ryan said as well. I mean, some of the classic things that I saw certainly in that technical content was that people couldn't explain what life expectancy was. So I mean, Ryan's used the words. Some people just clearly didn't understand what life expectancy was, and we do think that you at this stage in your actual career should know what life expectancy is. So you know, that's a sort of thing that doesn't impress an examiner or a marker when you can't really describe what life expectancy is, or you're very muddled in your approach. I think that's quite a key aspect to it. The other concern that people had was, given that it was a relatively technical question, and if you didn't remember the formula, you know, how few people could actually really pass. The interesting thing that I want to say is that actually people performed better on question one than they did on question two. And question two didn't rely on a formula and a technical ability. It was more of a communications question. So were the final results impacted by the technical nature of question one? My answer would be no. Actually, I think those people who communicated well on question one without even having the calculation or done the calculation, they still passed. And it was a question about how you communicated the facts across. So I think it was quite an important aspect to it. The other thing I think is worth probably noting in terms of what Ryan also said in terms of the communications aspect of it, and particularly the conclusion, is that a lot of people don't know how to conclude slide presentations. As Ryan said, it's not just a question of drawing the three things out and just putting them back in again or repeating things. People often just repeat the same phrases that they put in the presentation. You really need to think about what is the message that you are trying to convey at the end of the presentation. So please bear that in mind as well from a communication perspective. The communications markers actually put through some slides, so neither I nor I are actually in a great position to actually talk on these slides, but I'm going to run through them very briefly, just running through one or two things that I think are important, but they will be in the slide deck, which will go onto the ASA website, so you can pick these up from there, and you can work through them in your own time. But just to comment on a few aspects of them, so I'm not going to cover everything in the slides that they've put together. But, I mean, what we are looking for, and it's the same point that I've said before, is we really are looking for this cohesive message that must come through in your slide presentation. So the way it's structured actually will drive whether or not we think you are deserving of a pass in the end. So that is quite crucial. And the communications people in particular are looking for overall impression. They don't understand the technical content, so they're not even interested in whether you've got the right life expectancy or the right calculations. They don't even look at that at all. So bear that in mind. I can't remember the exact marks, Ryan, in terms of the tech. I know we don't put the mark schedule out, but I think you only lost 4 marks, if I remember correctly. So Ryan's nodding his head. So there were only 4 marks if you actually got those life expectancy numbers correct. Now, just bear that out of 200, because the technical markers basically are marking out of 100 and the communication aspect is marked out of 100. So it is not going to cause you to pass or fail if you didn't get those 4 marks. But it's, I think as Ryan pointed out, it did cause a lot of people to flounder in the exam. So just some of the things in terms of the detail of the range of slides that you need. The title slide, just basic things again, and we've talked about the basics, the title, the date, for whom it's being presented and who is doing the presenting, just has to be there on the title slide. Again, the number of people that just don't do that on the title slide staggers me. So please don't throw away easy marks. We do want a roadmap basically of where you're going to go, and it's, I know it's, in a sense, it's a bit of an abnormal thing in that you're doing a presentation for us to read rather than you actually presenting it. But you should be thinking about the fact that I could be presenting this. And if you were standing up here doing a presentation, explaining and answering that question from the trustees, in fact, you would be saying to the trustees, this is what I'm going to cover. And so you need to be thinking like that in the approach. And you can see the same point comes through in the communications markers, that you need to answer all of the questions that are being put to you. Make sure that all of the instructions are being met. Ryan said questions, I think you said, really don't have words that are wasted. In fact, I would go one step further to say that we are fastidious about making sure that the words that are in the question are actually needed. So if there's irrelevant facts in there, we would generally take those out. So in some way in the process, between the marker who sets it, the examiner who sets it, to the oversight that gets done, we would actually remove irrelevant facts. Because we don't want people often to be misled. Sometimes if you're asking to distill something or we're asking you to summarize something, we might have a whole lot of stuff and we want you to pull the most important facts out of that. But generally, the question is giving you the exact instructions of what you need to follow, and there aren't wasted words. So if there's something in there about HIV, you need to make sure that there's something in your answer about HIV. And in fact, that just doesn't apply to communications exam. That applies to all of the actuarial exams. So you can apply that principle to all of them. Okay, just the rest of the range of slides and coherence. Obviously, the body needs to address the points. As Ryan pointed out in this question, there were 8 instructions, actually. So you pretty much had to cover at least one per slide, or if you wanted to finish everything, you probably actually need to cover more than one in some of the slides to be able to fit it into the 10 slides. And then, as Ryan pointed out, they're looking to see, does the concluding slide bring everything together? Does it actually finish off the presentation rather than just repeat the facts that you've got in the presentation itself? So some of the detail, just in terms of headings, we would have liked to, one of the things that we asked people to do is to say things like explain life expectancy. That's such an easy thing to then have as a heading. So you'll see we would have expected that the major heading of slide 3 would be what is life expectancy, and then for you to have used that slide to explain life expectancy. It's a very straightforward thing to do, and yet I would say very few candidates actually use that as a heading. And we've given you the heading effectively in the instructions that we had of the question itself. So please be careful of that. The comments here are actually I don't know what the, do you know what the comment is? What's wrong with slide 8? Okay, so I'm not sure what that comment is. I'm sorry. If I can find it, I'll send through the detail on that particular point. the internal coherence and overall vision, visual impact of the slide. So sort of, again, looking at things and saying, is there consistency in terms of the way that you're doing things, or is it visually attractive to the audience? So putting in a graph or putting in, having the whole presentation points like we've got here is not that great and not that visually attractive, but you can come up with a graph, or you can come up with some sort of graphic that breaks the flow of it, it definitely helps, and the communications markers like that. So think about in terms of the approach that you're having when you're structuring your things. Can you put a graph in? Can you put something in that actually changes and makes things look a little bit different? I'm appreciative that the presentation is quite boring in comparison to what I would normally expect. We've talked about language, and we've said language a number of times. Language is quite crucial in terms of who you're presenting to here. So this was to a set of trustees. So you would need to, the members of the fund, you would need to be able to use examples and say things which they would understand. So that's quite crucial and quite important. And make sure that all of those things are appropriate as well. And then again, I mean, the communications markers actually had specific marks available for the overall impression that the presentation gave them. So they would look at everybody's, and again, they're not looking at the content, they're looking at what they feel the presentation would have come across. Is it coherent? Does it have a logical development? And what's the sort of structure of and the feel of it? So all of those things are quite important from a communication perspective, and you can score half your marks on the communication side of things.
Peter, one thing that I know I really struggled with the presentation is what to actually include with regards to the words, because you know when you present a presentation, it's easier to put together because there's aspects of it that you can actually explain, but when you're writing it out, it gets a bit tricky because some sentences are obviously a bit too long to include in a presentation. So you know, and especially with the fact that there isn't a word count, you sort of struggle with how much to include and what's important and what's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a good point, and it's a good question. We do look at that. So if you write a paragraph in your presentation, it's not going to go down well with the communications people, and you're going to lose lots of marks. But I think we also are appreciative of the fact that sometimes, you know, I might be able to put up one line on tone, and I can explain that when I'm standing here in front of you, but you wouldn't be able to do that in an exam question. So you probably do have to have a little bit more in terms of words than you would have if you were just having an opportunity to explain, but be careful that you don't get yourself caught into sentences and paragraphs. It was somebody in the, I don't know if it was this exam or the previous one, their presentation, I mean, it was terrible. They were about, each bullet point had four or five lines. It was like an essay, and I mean, that's clearly not right. So you probably would have slightly more than you would have if you were just doing it as a verbal presentation, but make sure it's still not long sentences. So that is the trick. If you have a look at the model solutions, you can see some of the model solutions have slightly more words than probably we would have liked. But I think we understand that is because you're doing it as a written. Any other questions on that? That's question one. As I said, question one is actually answered better than question two, even though people thought that they did worse on question one. So most people actually, I think it was about 5% difference actually between question one and question two. From an overall perspective.
All right, so for question two, go through the same process. You need to have this buttoned down as a standard process that you apply in tackling these questions. So here were all the facts. You'd got an email from your mother, you needed to reply to your mother and explain why this offer looked so attractive, but then recommend to her that she didn't take it. So immediately it sounded confusing, so you had to make head or tail of what was going on. So there were the facts. I think what let a lot of people down in this question is not getting the facts right. There seemed to be some misunderstanding of some of the numbers and how they related to each other. When we saw that the initial trial papers, we went back to the question, check was it clear as to what the numbers meant and what they were, how they were intended to use, and we were happy it was clear enough, but there still were a few who misinterpreted what some of the numbers were. I'll come to that now. Alright, so here again, there were quite a few instructions that you had to follow. The important one was write an email with your word count. You had to put in how much was she going to pay for the benefits, both the death benefit and the cashback benefit. How much was she going to get out? So these were fairly simple calculations. You then had to do a little comparison. So if you were to invest money she was paying for those benefits at the 12% a year, how much would she get out from that? And then maybe the one that was a little tricky was explain how. How did the company get to this generous, what appeared to be a very generous benefit? I'll deal with that just now. Okay, draw attention to the risks. Most questions like this will have something about risk in it, so you need to be able to identify where could this go wrong. And then make a recommendation that she doesn't take it, and then you have to use those numbers that you've been given to illustrate. Okay, those were your examples. You were told how what example to use. All right, so of the instructions that were omitted, these were the three most common. So explaining how the cashback is so generous. And on the risks, little detail on the risks. I'll cover that just now. And then the comparison to an investment of 12%. Okay. Okay. So this question, in answering how the company could offer such a generous benefit, you had to perhaps think a little bit about where the money was going, who was getting and who wasn't getting money. And the benefit design gave you some clues. The benefit design said that if the person didn't pay their premiums or they canceled the policy or if they died, they didn't get anything back. So that money is going somewhere. That was the indication that that's where this generous return was coming from. Okay. Okay. The important point here is that if you're going to convince someone that something is correct, you have to be able to give them a reasonable explanation. You can't just make a statement that something is right and not support it with anything. So a lot of people might have just made the statement that the number is correct, because we've said in previous sessions that you need to always confirm that something's right. But if you do make that statement, you do need to substantiate. You do need to explain why it's correct. Otherwise, it's not believable to the reader. Okay. So it was an important part here to come with some good plausible reasons as to why the benefit was generous, how they could make it a generous benefit. Okay, and then be careful of getting trapped in looking at just one element. So in this example, there were quite a few risks that you could identify. Most people focused on the risk that the premium could go up in future. But there were some more fundamental risks. If your mother had bought this benefit, there were some more fundamental risks to her owning it than the premiums going up in the future. There was the fact that if she didn't need any more and she cancelled it, she that she'd put in. If she missed a premium, she would lose the benefit. So there were other risks that were mostly ignored because people just focused on one particular risk. Also, when you're answering a question about risks, think about the relative importance of risks, because not all risks are the same, and there's an opportunity to look for something and say, yes, this is a risk, but actually it's unlikely. Okay, and that's where you'll often see comments that the market is well regulated or something like that, because it's well managed. The risk of the company going insolvent and not being able to pay the benefits, yes, there's a risk, but it's very, very small. So those are useful things to look out for as opportunities for marks. Okay. All right, then just doing the compound interest calculations. It's also very basic actuarial concept that you need to be able to do. A lot of people who did get them wrong. So you have to make sure you can do these accurately and quickly anytime. Okay. But the important thing to be able to show that the benefit was valuable if it was just the cashback on its own, roll up the premium, the 165 Rand at 12%, and show that the cashback offered much better value at 128,000 versus the 63,000 that it rolled up to. But that if you invested the whole premium, the 715, you'd get substantially more than the 128,000. Okay, so that was the catch. Okay, so again, sort of what's the big picture, what's going on? Okay, those that meet the cashback benefits get a benefit, those who don't get nothing. And then what's it worth if I need the death benefit and I'm paying that premium for it? Yes, it's a valuable benefit. The cashback is a valuable benefit, but what's it worth if I don't need the death benefit? I'm just having to pay that premium to access the cashback. Okay, so that was what was going on. All right. All right, so this is where some of the confusion came into interpreting the numbers. So it's about reading the question carefully. So there was a 550 Rand premium for the death benefit, but quite a number of people interpreted the 550 to be the total premium, inclusive of the 30%. And on rereading the question, by the markers reading the question, going over it, there really wasn't a reason to interpret that from the question. So you have to make sure that you interpret it correctly. Okay, so as soon as you get that wrong, it messes up all the numbers and you're going to struggle to make up a sensible conclusion. Okay. Calculation errors. The one that floored me was the multiplication. So 715 times 12 times 15. All sorts of different numbers. You cannot make mistakes like that. Even though you might be under time pressure to finish it. Okay. And then, as I mentioned, accumulating the 165 and the 715 at 1% a month, 15 years. It should be able to do it quite quickly and easily. Okay. Another thing, just to, I know you're under time pressure and there are lots of things that you need to think about and do, but just check for reasonability. We see examples where someone's got an accumulation with interest that adds up to something, that accumulates to something that is more than just, sorry, that is less than the total of what's going in. There's something wrong. Go back, revisit it. So just have a look at it. Does it make sense when you're reading those numbers? Do they correspond with the other numbers that are in your workings? Okay. All right. Then be specific about your comparison. So if you're trying to highlight the difference between two things or how one thing compares to another, directly draw the reader's attention to it. Don't just state two facts and then hope that the reader is going to establish the relationship between them or do the comparison themselves. Okay. Especially if it's someone like a layperson, in this case your mother, who probably doesn't know the first thing about life insurance or the benefits, then you need to be quite specific about the comparing the results and making sure they actually get the message that you wanted to get across. Okay. Also look for opportunities where information can be used more than once. We've said there won't be any wasted information, but in this question, there were actually, when you looked at that policy cancelled, premiums missed, life assured died, those three pieces of information could be used in answering three of those instructions. It was part of the benefit features. It was part of the risks to the person who buys the product. And also explained how it was a generous benefit. So don't just assume that once you've used it once, it can't be used again. Okay. If it makes sense as part of answering the instructions, then you can make use of that information again. Okay. I don't think that is being repetitive. That is answering a different question, and you can't expect the layperson then to draw a link from answering a different instruction. Okay. All right, any questions on that one? Okay.
And just to supplement what Ryan was saying as well, I saw one person's answer saying about the question about saying, yes, the numbers are correct. Somebody actually, I think, said started the email like this and said, thanks for writing to me, Mom. My actual training hasn't gone to waste. The numbers are definitely correct. Trust me. And your mother may or may not be trustworthy, be trusting of you in those circumstances. But I think the markers are not going to give you marks for that. So you do need to, I just strengthen Ryan's point there, is to say you do need to have justification as to why what you're suggesting or your numbers, your calculations are correct, not just I'm an actuary, trust me. I don't think people always will do that in the future. So bear that in mind as well. Just some of the general stuff, just firstly on the email side of things. So I have talked about the structure and making sure that you get the structures and you have thought about who you're writing to. So in this particular case, you needed to think clearly that it's my mother. How would I write an email to my mother? And when you're finished, you should read it and say, is this the type of email I would have written to my mother? I think probably, 25% of candidates, if they'd stopped and done that, I think they would have been surprised and realized actually they haven't written at the right level with the right sort of tone. So think very carefully about that. Just from a structure perspective, that is the way that we would normally expect people to do. Sometimes we say you can leave out the address line. Just look at the question and see what it says. But if not, that's what you should be doing from a structure perspective. And your greeting obviously needs to be appropriate for the person you're writing to. And then again, one of the key things is going to be your opening paragraph in terms of how you were responding to somebody. So please make sure then there must be a logical train of thought. We do look for that. So does it make sense as people move through in terms of the content? Again, if you can give examples, it's examples. So please do that. And avoid anything that's jargon. There are a lot of actuaries, we use a lot of things that we just sort of expect, compound interest, words like that, which we might just use as your normal day-to-day language, when lay people will not know. So be careful that you haven't got any jargon in your answer to questions, particularly to lay people. You can see also they say things like stock phrases and cliches. I think lots of people do that a lot of times. And then obviously you need to have an appropriate conclusion, making sure that it's clear. If we asked, sometimes we ask for advice, we say recommend a course of action or whatever, please make sure that your conclusion does cover that as well. And then an appropriate greeting, depending on what it needs to be. So if you just look at the sample solution, and there was a sample solution posted, you can go and have a look at the details of it. And this will give you an idea of how where the marks come from as well. We don't normally publish all of that, but this will give you some degree of idea of that. So the length, there are 4 marks available for sticking to the word count. The sample solution was 505 words, right between the 475 and 525, and it excludes the greeting and the sign-off, so you didn't have to count those. Then the format, and actually the communications person said there's actually a great example of how to format it and the tone to use, because your mother had written to you, so you can actually copy that in return to her. That was the easy way to get to what you needed to get to. And the greeting needs to be informal, so hi, Mom, dear Mom, and you finish with love, whatever, as your answer. So please make sure that you do that. And then make sure it's not colloquial. I think somebody actually did put how's it as the heading that I saw. So it sounds, again, ridiculous, but yet people somehow manage to do it. Or you definitely wouldn't use, some very formal greeting for your mother either. 16 marks on the language, so focused on the words that you use, the level of language that you're using, is it appropriate for your mother, avoiding jargon, all of that stuff. So that is quite a key aspect to the total marks. How explainable and understanding is it? And you've got to be careful in terms of what you, and obviously make sure that you're not misstating facts. So, in fact, I did say that earlier, the markers, the communication markers, picked up a whole lot of misstatement of facts, and they weren't even the technical people. So they were saying, I can calculate how many ever premiums it was, and it's just a straightforward multiplication. And certainly, you would think your mother even could do that calculation. So if you get that wrong, if I was your mother, I'd be wondering what I did spend my training money for in terms of your training. And actually, a lot of those candidates who didn't get those calculations right, they failed. We didn't necessarily treat it as a fatal flaw, but it did damage your credibility and ability to answer the question. So please make sure that you get the language right. And the thing is, it got almost double penalized, because it got penalized in the technical marks, and then the communications markers, when they looked at the content and the language, penalized people again. So that's why most of those people didn't pass. You do need to plan and structure your answers. We actually give marks for it. So we and the communications markers will actually look and say, does this answer make sense? Does it look like somebody actually spent some time thinking about how they were going to answer this question before they actually answered it? So there are quite a lot of marks there, 15 marks based on that. So it's imperative that you think and spend time actually doing that as well. And then, as I said, we generally do it, not always, but we generally give marks for overall impression. And in this particular case, there were 10 marks available on the overall impression, which is questions like things that we will ask ourselves are, how does the whole email hang together? Does it feel right from our perspective? Would mom follow the explanation that you've given? Does that make sense? And those are the ways we would think about that. And then again, just simple things like grammar mistakes, typos, and omissions is not a good thing. So if your mom has asked you for something and you haven't answered it, obviously that's not going to reflect well on you. So those are all important aspects and score relatively heavily. I want to ask one question before we take any other questions from you guys. How many people who wrote that exam answered question 2 before they answered question 1? Okay, so there's about 4 or 5 people in total. If I was doing this exam, I would have definitely written question 2 before I did question 1. It's one of the things I say to students. I actually lecture a whole lot of courses in actuarial thinking. You do not need to answer questions in the order that they are set. So you don't have to go through from question 1 through to question 10. And then the same thing with communications. You don't have to do question 1 before you do question 2. You can do question 2 before you do question 1. And I would have done it because of 2 things. One, that presentation had a technical aspect to it, which required you to think a little bit. And if you were going to be under pressure in terms of the calculations, you want to leave that for second. 2, this was actually a lot easier question to answer in my view. I would have answered this question much quicker. I probably would have used a third of the time to answer this and used 2/3 of my time to do the presentation. So a lot of people think I'm going to allocate 50-50 of my time. I don't think you should think about that. You should say, can I answer one of these questions better and quicker in less time available, which gives me more time to answer the more complicated question. So I would have definitely done question 2 first. And I would have spent probably about 1/3 of my time on question 2, and I would have given myself 2/3 of my time to do the presentation, which I think was a harder question, and it would have probably consumed more of my time. Now, that may have varied, so you might have been the first person to write down the formula and feeling like you could have knocked off the first question quickly, but my guess is the bulk of candidates probably should have done question 2 first and not question 1 first, and yet very few people did that. So think about the order that you do questions, and free advice for your technical papers as well. I'm the examiner on A301 exam, and I can tell you that the number of times that I can see the people who have failed or don't get to the last question, and often they are doing very well on the last question, and they just have run out of time. And if that actually started with that last question, which tends to always be the biggest mark question, they would have done much better, and they possibly would have passed the paper. So don't answer questions in the sequence that you find them in exams. Figure out which answers you want to answer, and you know good answers, and answer it in that sequence. It's the best piece of advice I can give you, and probably the one the least of you will follow. So I'm fully aware of that because I can see the answers are done in the structures of the questions. But you really, really shouldn't be answering it in the way the exam is set. You should be thinking about what you want to do in terms of answering the paper, something you can control. Has anybody got any other questions, anything that they would like to ask while you have Ryan and myself here? Okay, we've got a couple. I'll take the one back and I'll come back to you.
I find the communications papers are very much focused on life or pensions or investments, and then there's some of the areas that's never questioned. Do you think there's an advantage if you work in the life space that you would be able to answer a life question easier, and then if you're in a different area that you actually don't work, that you would actually have a disadvantage?
It's a good question. I do think we try to ask diverse questions. What you might be suggesting is that we're not successful in that. So we'll think a bit about more about it. So in future. I think we do try to ask questions that are not necessarily in a particular field. They are sometimes in a field, and it's sometimes a lot easier to ask certain questions. So, you know, doing a presentation to the trustees of a pension fund, it's an easy thing for us to ask. I don't think there was anything in there that actually would challenge your technical knowledge and would, if you were in the field, could you do better? Possibly. I think it's something that you should be able to pass. I do think we also try to do questions that are generic in nature. And not necessarily based on one field or another. So this one did have a life question and a pensions question, and dealt with life expectancy as well. But some of the other papers, if you look back, you'll see might just be a simple compound interest question, which any actuary, really, regardless of what field you work in, you should be able to do well enough in. And even, you know, this question on the bonus side of things, cashback bonus. I mean, that was really more compound interest question than a life question per se. But I think it's a good point, and we certainly will, as examiners, we don't try to focus on a particular field. We don't want to give, you know, just an advantage because you happen to be in that field. But having said that, sometimes I think it's, you know, the question you might just know the answer easier and better. I remember I said this last time I did a presentation. When I wrote the communications exam, the question asked me to explain APR. I did it through the UK. I had not the foggiest idea what APR actually stood for at the time. I remember the concept of it from a compound interest thing, but I couldn't remember even what the three letters stood for. It's bloody hard to pass an exam when you can't explain to the person actually what the three letters stand for. And they didn't explain it. They didn't say it in the question. So, you know, anybody who was living in the UK clearly, you know, use it all the time, and they would have known what to have said. But I wasn't in that position. So it does, your knowledge can affect your ability to pass the exam. I didn't pass, no. Surprisingly. It's hard to pass an exam when you can't explain the concept to them. And I knew I didn't pass straight away.
I know you say we shouldn't use jargon, so I guess my question is, what do we then use if we can't use the word inflation rate or we can't use the word compound interest? How do we get around that?
I'm trying to pass it off to Ryan, but he doesn't want to. I think sometimes you can use the word. So, if your mother's asked you for an explanation of something, I think you can use that word, but you must be careful that you're not using, like, compound interest. I wouldn't use the phrase compound interest to explain something. You can say to your mother, you know, what happens is you get growth on your interest, you know, something like that. You need to go for a layman's explanation of it. So I think the problem is a lot of times we don't even think about not using jargon. We just throw them in there, and that's quite important. The other thing is you can't use the word to explain the word. So There were a few people actually that did that in the exam, asked to explain what longevity means, and then they used the word longevity in the explanation. You just can't do that. It's a very common thing. People do it all the time. So be aware of that as well. I know you want to comment.
But the other thing you can try is if you need to use the word inflation, maybe you can, if you've got space in words, to be able to give some sort of explanation of what it means. Then I think it becomes less of jargon. It now has some meaning to the user.
And you can also use an example. So you can say, if you're trying to explain inflation to your mother, you would say, actually, as you know, the price of bread goes up every year, and that's inflation. But you know, we didn't, and particularly the question that we did have on inflation was the one with the Director General. We would not have expected you to explain inflation to him. He would have known what inflation is. So that's what you need to think about, who am I writing to. Other questions?
So in the presentation question, how important was the conclusion? Say someone had done all the calculations correctly, but maybe ran out of time to make the conclusions, particularly that 71%, how would you view that? Say you had like an empty presentation slide.
Not finishing the question is probably not a good thing, as a general rule. There should be enough time. You've got 3 hours to do the exam plus your reading time. So you shouldn't be pressed on time. We try not to make it pressed on time. We're not trying to challenge you in terms of that regard. So it is quite important to actually have the thing finished. And one of the questions is, what would you do? What would happen in that situation? Well, you're going to lose marks for a couple of things. You're going to lose marks because you haven't got the conclusion. So that's going to be 4 or 5 marks gone, and it's going to actually impact both the technical mark and also the communications mark. It's going to impact the overall impression. So the communications markers are going to say, out of 10, what would a presentation be like if I didn't have a conclusion slide? And they would say, that's not leaving me a good impression. So I think you're out of 4 or 5 suddenly. You're going to lose another 4 or 5 marks straight away from that. So it's going to impact you in a number of places. So I would say it's more important to actually to put your structure in place and show that you've got a conclusion than have some of the content organized. So I would say finish. Make sure your letter's signed and make sure your emails are signed off and your presentation's got a conclusion slide. And I would say most people who don't have those are not going to pass. So you're going to battle. I don't know if you want to comment. Yeah, Ryan agrees with me. So, anything else? Anybody got any other questions? Last opportunity. You're welcome to come ask us. We'll be here for a bit, but thank you for coming. I hope you pass. We don't actually want to keep on marking your papers, so good luck. I trust it goes well.